The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
One of Houston, Texas's most well-known and infamous unsolved cases is the August 1990 murders of Cheryl Henry and Andy Atkinson. Both of them, 22 years old and 21 years old respectively, were found brutally slain near an isolated cul-de-sac in the city's far west. Cheryl and Andy had been bound at the wrists with rope, and their throats deeply slashed. Cheryl had been raped. At the time, this area was heavily wooded and undeveloped, a spot that was known as a place young couples could park and do what sweethearts do with little fear of being busted by the cops or anyone else. Andy and Cheryl's terrible end became known throughout Texas as the Lover's Lane murders of Houston. In 2007, the Houston police got word that a DNA profile obtained from semen collected from Cheryl's body matched DNA collected from a rape victim that same year, but a month earlier. This survivor had worked a shift as a dancer at a club called Gigi's and was attacked a little before 3 a.m. in her boyfriend's home while he was away working as a commercial airline pilot. The rapist, who wore a fishnet stocking over his face, black gloves, and what appeared to be a uniform, dark in color, put a long-barreled pistol to the survivor's head and cocked back the hammer. He asked where her boyfriend was by name, and then bound the survivor's hands behind her back with silver duct tape, which he also placed over the woman's eyes and mouth before placing a bag over her head and raping her. After matching the DNA of the survivor's attacker to the rapist and murderer of Cheryl Henry, Houston detectives tracked down the woman, and a composite sketch was made of the rapist. His face under the fishnet stockings was burned into the woman's mind. Cheryl Henry, like the survivor of this monster, worked at an adult entertainment establishment, Rick's Cabaret. And perhaps just as interesting a clue is the fact that the survivor says she once worked for the father of the other victim of the Houston Lover's Lane murder, Andy Atkinson. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, many young women in and around Houston vanished, some leaving behind clear-cut signs of foul play, but no clues as to their whereabouts. Some vanished, though, with not so much as a trace. In 1993, a woman who worked at the adult entertainment establishment, the Men's Club, Tara Breckenridge, went missing. Some suspect the same rapist and killer in the Lover's Lane murders for Tara's disappearance. While Daryl Breckenridge was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base in Kern, California, he and his wife Betty welcomed into the world a baby girl on September 30, 1968. They named her Tara Suzette. Tara was the fourth-born child to Daryl and Betty. They had a total of six children, three boys and three girls. Unlike many of the kids of career military men and women, Tara Breckenridge and her siblings got to do the majority of their growing up in one place. Not long after Tara's birth, the Breckenridge family moved to Del Rio, Texas, home of Laughlin Air Force Base. Tara attended Del Rio schools grades 1 through 12. By the time she got to Del Rio High, Tara became immensely interested in photography. She was extremely active in photography class, worked as a carrier for the local paper, the Del Rio News Herald, and even scored a job there as a photographer after she graduated in 1987. In fact, she's credited under many photos in the small city newspaper. The year prior to graduation, however, she and the rest of the Breckenridge family was dealt the first of many tragic blows. On Easter Sunday in 1986, Tara's oldest sibling, her sister Tammy, and her roommate accompanied an Air Force T-38 jet pilot instructor and a student pilot on a thrill ride in a single-engine Cessna 171 Skyhawk. Witnesses on shore and Lake Amistad boaters alike later reported that they saw the plane flying under bridges, performing dangerous acrobatic maneuvers, and flying only around 60 feet above the water. At about 3:15 p.m. that day, the low-flying plane stalled just as the pilot tried to clear a 100-foot-high hill. The plane crashed into the hill's side about 15 feet above the water. The Cessna bounced into the lake, and everyone aboard was killed. While two of the bodies floated to the water's surface and were easily recovered, Tammy Breckenridge and one of the young men aboard had to be retrieved by divers at the bottom of Lake Amistad. Tammy was only 23 years old, and the Breckenridge family was devastated. Perhaps their faith is what helped move the Breckenridges forward after this great loss. The family was active in the Church of Latter-day Saints. Within a year of graduating from Del Rio High, in January of 1988, Tara Breckenridge moved away from home to take photography at the Art Institute of Houston. Pursuing her passion 350 miles away from home wasn't easy, financially speaking, and that endeavor became even more difficult after she began dating and moved in with a man named Wayne Hecker. Hecker was frequently unemployed, leaving Tara to support them both much of the time. In 1989, Tara took a job waiting tables at an upscale adult entertainment bar called the Men's Club. She'd worked in such establishments before, and in fact, she didn't mind the atmosphere at all. The money, anyway, was great, and she certainly loved that. Not that it was their place to say one way or the other, but Tara's family and friends were fine with her choice to take jobs in the adult entertainment industry. According to those friends and family, however, her boyfriend Wayne Hecker wasn't happy about it at all. But because Tara was the breadwinner, Hecker usually bit his tongue about it. Tara paying most of the bills, naturally, soured the relationship between her and Hecker over time. Tara's mother Betty later commented that her daughter often spoke about moving out of Hecker's home. Sometimes, Betty Breckenridge said, Tara contemplated speaking with Hecker before doing so, and sometimes she'd considered leaving without talking to her boyfriend first. Whether this particular problem had anything to do with her demeanor on July 10th through 19th, 1992, is unknown. She was back in Del Rio visiting her family and friends during that time, and though Tara didn't mention to her parents that anything specific was bothering her, they could tell, they said, something was wrong. 2 weeks after returning to Houston, Tara's co-workers witnessed behavior that suggested her parents were right. Tara Breckenridge rarely left a shift at the Men's Club early. She always preferred to stay as long as she could in order to make as much money as possible. So, when she volunteered to leave work early on Monday, August 3rd, 1992, when the club's manager wanted to send a couple waitresses home due to slow business, her co-workers thought it was odd, out of character. Even her manager Hal later commented that Tara offering to leave early was unusual. She almost always liked to stay until her shift ended at 2 a.m., he said. Regardless, Tara changed clothes at the club before clocking out at 12:29 a.m., now Tuesday, August 4th, 1992. There was also another sign that something wasn't right. As she left the club, the doorman said goodbye to Tara, but she didn't respond. This wasn't like the young woman at all. Generally, she was incredibly friendly and responsive to greetings. A security guard walked Tara to her red 1986 Pontiac Fiero, carrying her tote bag for her. This was a routine precaution and requirement for the Men's Club in order to minimize the risk of harm to their employees. Besides her uncharacteristic behavior, neither the security guard nor the doorman noticed anything strange or even out of the ordinary that night as Tara Breckenridge started up her car and drove out of the lot. However, it was the last time the 23-year-old woman would ever be seen again. ¶¶ Okay, so you long-time Gone Cold listeners know by now that I'm completely obsessed with Best Fiends. In fact, I'm willing to state unequivocally that it's the best Match 3-style puzzle game out there. If you're bored with one of those other Match 3 games that are just crushing candy or different colored gems or whatever, they're all the same, you should give something fresh a try. And by that, of course, I mean Best Fiends. Best Fiends actually has a storyline. Good guys in the form of cute little fiends and bad guys by way of dastardly slimy slugs. Your fiends start out as little baby bugs and other small creatures, and grow into fully realized slug-busting badasses as you level them up. They get even more powerful as they grow, helping you gain the firepower you need to make your way through the action-packed, increasingly challenging and brain-boosting game. My Best Fiends army has gotten me all the way up to level 4611 as I speak, and I don't plan on giving them rest anytime soon, since I'm always looking for a challenge that simultaneously gives me a break and gives my brain a little pick-me-up. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play to do the same. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. On Tuesday, August 4th, 1992, Tara Breckenridge's boyfriend, Wayne Hecker, returned home at about 5 a.m. He'd later say he expected to see Tara there, either in bed or passed out on the sofa. He found neither. Earlier the previous night, Hecker had called the men's club to speak with Tara, but the person who answered the phone there told the man that she was on the floor and could not talk. Hecker never got a call back from Tara, he later said, but he didn't think much of it at the time. This claim is potentially important, but we'll get back to that later. Hecker had, quote, worked himself until 3:30 a.m., and after, gone out with some friends. The man says he was at a pool hall with friends at the approximate time Tara left her shift at the men's club. According to what I've seen, Tara's boyfriend was supposed to be working as a barback at this pool hall, but spent much of the time hanging out with friends instead of doing his job. I only point that out because it jives with the fact that Wayne Hecker was often unemployed. Either way, according to Hecker, he returned home at 5 a.m. that morning with a friend, and both started searching for Tara upon discovering she wasn't there. This included driving up to the men's club to see if, for some reason, Tara was still there. Hecker and his friend were not able to locate her, but they did find something. At 7 a.m. that morning, Wayne Hecker found Tara's 1986 red Pontiac Fiero abandoned by the side of the highway. Specifically, the vehicle was at the 1200 block of the West Loop North Freeway between Interstate 10 and Highway 290 near 12th Street. This location is about 3 miles straight south of the men's club, and was along the route Tara Breckenridge normally traveled both to and from work. Though Tara's car was locked, Hecker said he was surprised and worried to find that the alarm wasn't set. The car's emergency flashers were not on. Inside the vehicle was the can of mace Tara normally carried with her for protection. There was nothing in or around Tara's Fiero to suggest a struggle had taken place. Still, Hecker later commented, finding the vehicle there with the alarm disabled was troubling, and he felt something terrible had happened to his girlfriend. He called the Houston police. When the cops arrived, they began inspecting in and around Tara Breckenridge's car. Nothing looked amiss immediately, but when they popped the hood, officers discovered that the alternator belt was missing. This, according to reports, led police to immediately speculate that Tara had been abducted, meaning, presumably, that they theorized her car had been tampered with. And that could be the case. Again, this location was 3 miles from the men's club, and a car will run without the alternator belt for a few minutes. So it's plausible the alternator belt was removed at the club and her car broke down on the way home. However, it seems unlikely that no security guard or doorman would have seen somebody removing it from Tara's car in the parking lot there. Perhaps, though, it was the work of whoever is responsible for Tara's disappearance to make it look like car trouble to throw the cops off. A description of Tara Breckenridge hit the Houston Chronicle on August 6, 1992, along with a story detailing the known facts. Tara is a white female, the description read, with brown eyes and shoulder-length, slightly curly, light brown hair. She stands 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighs 110 pounds. On Tara's lower lip is a small scar, and under her left arm and left side of her body are two more scars. Tara's two upper front teeth have some discoloring. The description continues. She wears contact lenses or glasses, and her fingernails are usually painted red. She was last seen wearing a white or light-colored shirt, light blue shorts, sandals, and a Del Rio high ring that reads Class of 1987. For the next several months, Houston newspapers and local television stations ran a few stories about the missing young woman, but mostly there was little to report. Almost no clues were left behind, and no one was coming forward with substantive information. Tara's friends and family, meanwhile, began circulating flyers and posters all but immediately. The missing woman's place of employment, too, leapt to action by putting up a $5,000 reward for the arrest and conviction of anyone involved in Tara's disappearance. Eventually, that reward would grow to $15,000. The month following Tara's disappearance, her best friend Gina, along with other friends and family members, began collecting donations to erect billboards featuring her photo and description. Two companies that owned billboards and wished to remain anonymous donated the space itself for several, but it was up to friends and family to raise money to actually print them. Perhaps the first major lead in Tara Breckenridge's disappearance came when police discovered a collection of love letters to her. The letters were from a customer at the men's club who took a liking to Tara. Along with $100 tips, this man would slip Tara notes asking her to do what her heart tells her, and the longer she holds out, the more she jeopardizes the way he feels about her. Marriage, according to one of the note's lines, was apparently what this guy was looking for, and apparently still the man knew about Tara's relationship troubles with Wayne Hecker. The letter writer was certainly the first person of interest in Tara's disappearance, but this never-named individual was also one of the first, if not the first, to be eliminated after Houston police interviewed him. Houston Homicide Sergeant Brad Rudolph later said the notes were never threatening, and that this man had a crush on Tara Breckenridge and nothing more. Then police suspicion turned to Tara's boyfriend, Wayne Hecker. Police Sergeant Rudolph of Houston Homicide interviewed Wayne Hecker, and during his investigation said he found several reasons to place his suspicion in the man. The pool hall where Hecker was the night Tara disappeared was about a 15-minute drive from the men's club where she worked. Tara's 1986 Fiero was found about 3 miles from the club, a drive that likely wouldn't have taken any more than 5 minutes on a Tuesday at 12:30 a.m., which was around the time she was seen leaving work. Witnesses at the pool hall told police that Wayne Hecker left for possibly as long as an hour and 45 minutes that night. In fact, they said Hecker left between midnight and 12:30 and wasn't seen again at the pool hall until around 1:45 a.m. Now, Wayne Hecker is a suspect in Tara Breckenridge's disappearance, and it is certainly possible he is responsible. On the other hand, however, an hour and 45 minutes to find Tara, kill her, dump her body, and ditch the car seems like a stretch. The significant amount of time it would take to dump her body somewhere she wouldn't be found is a problem with this theory, especially considering Tara disappeared from an extremely populated part of Houston, a part of Houston that is surrounded in every direction by other extremely populated parts. It is, however, important to remember that the couple had problems and that Tara had spoken with friends and family members extensively about leaving Hecker. When you consider that many rumors contain at least a sliver of truth, suspicion towards Wayne Hecker seems even stronger. According to folks claiming to be co-workers, Hecker was extremely controlling of Tara. She had to call him every night as she was leaving, these people say, and if she didn't get home fast enough to suit him, he'd begin repeatedly calling the men's club asking for her. It should come as no surprise to anyone listening to this podcast that men who display controlling behavior like this are often abusive in other ways as well. Other rumor suggests that Hecker asked the bartender at the pool hall that night to say he was there the entire time. These are things we cannot confirm, and Wayne Hecker has always maintained his innocence. The man did report Tara's disappearance quickly. "He's not been charged with a crime," Hecker said, "because he's not committed one. Tara," he said, "was the best thing that ever happened to him, and he loves her." Hecker commented it's possible he'll be under suspicion his entire life, but there's nothing he can do about it. Houston Homicide Sergeant Brad Rudolph says that though certain actions and reactions displayed by the man cast suspicion, the department has absolutely no evidence to support the belief he is involved. Several months after the disappearance of Tara Breckenridge came the wild card, Robert Beatty. Even before graduating from South Houston High in 1993, Robert Louis Beatty had a history of impersonating law enforcement. Since the disappearance of Tara Breckenridge, Beatty had been contacting media outlets asking for and offering up information about her case. He'd contacted friends and acquaintances of Tara, called witnesses who had already been interviewed and asked further questions, got in touch with the private investigator the Breckenridge family had hired, and was even in contact with the Houston police, all while posing as a Harris County Sheriff's Office deputy. In February of 1993, 7 months after Tara Breckenridge went missing, Beatty contacted Tara's parents for the first time, claiming the same law enforcement credentials. About a month later, in late March, Robert Beatty called Tara's parents, Daryl and Betty Breckenridge, and told them he'd solved their daughter's case and was ready to make an arrest. But it gets weirder. Identifying himself as a Harris County deputy, 18-year-old Robert Beatty called for a press conference to be held on March 30th, a little less than 2 weeks after billboards for Tara went up across the city of Houston. The fake cop told reporters that Tara's body could be found somewhere near Magnolia in Montgomery County, not far outside the Harris County line to the northwest. Beatty also told them that he might be arresting a friend of Tara's mother for obstruction of justice. He was planning a search of the area near Magnolia, he said, and indeed, the 18-year-old had already contacted television news teams, the Houston police, and the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, who he convinced easily to volunteer men and resources by dropping the right names and actual facts about the case. The day after his little press conference, in a subdivision in far south Montgomery County, authorities from the sheriff's office there and from Harris County were to meet. At the intersection of Farm to Market Roads 1488 and 2978, both Montgomery County and Harris County authorities were surprised when they arrived to find homicide detectives from Houston already there. But these detectives weren't there to find a body. Rather, they were there for the man who'd called these searches. Knowing there were no searches or even evidence that would warrant a search, the policeman from Houston showed up in hopes Robert Louis Beatty would be there so they could take him into custody. Beatty had, after all, promised to bring the tracking dogs. Houston Homicide Sergeant Brad Rudolph was itching to interrogate the teenager, since he had made specific comments that showed deep knowledge about the Tara Breckenridge case. Beatty didn't show. So, the cops came to him. On the 4600 block of North Braeswood Boulevard, Houston police arrested Robert Louis Beatty at his apartment in front of the television news crew they brought along, charging the 18-year-old with impersonating a police officer. Inside Beatty's apartment, detectives found handcuffs, a BB gun, and many sensationalistic and trashy detective magazines. It seemed clear that Beatty was obsessed with police officers. The teenager claimed that he really was investigating the disappearance of Tara Breckenridge, and the only way he thought folks would take him seriously was if he posed as law enforcement. Tara's mother, Betty Breckenridge, told reporters that during their talks with Robert Beatty, he said he had the suspects and their daughter's disappearance nailed down to either a cab driver or a wannabe detective. Beatty was both. He'd begun driving cabs not too long before he involved himself in Tara's case. Ultimately, neither the Houston police nor Mr. and Mrs. Breckenridge believed that the teenager had anything to do with the missing person's case. He was just a flake, Daryl Breckenridge said, and they had no hope that he could offer any real leads in Tara's disappearance. Not long after this fiasco, in April of 1993, Robert Louis Beatty pleaded guilty to impersonating a police officer and was sentenced to 10 years probation. He also had to complete at least 90 days at a shock probation boot camp. Beatty had changed his tune a little at this point and opened up more honestly when he finally admitted his impersonating a deputy to investigate Tara's murder gave him a, quote, head rush. But Beatty's story doesn't end there. After only 3 weeks at the Harris County boot camp, he escaped, was captured, and sent to serve 120 days at a Texas State Prison boot camp. This time, Beatty successfully finished his sentence. But when he was released to a halfway house in late 1993, he refused to comply with the rules there and was brought back before Judge Denise Collins. Since he couldn't meet the terms of probation, the judge was considering what to do with the troublemaker and set a hearing. In the meantime, she ordered Beatty to remain in custody. When the judge left the bench at that proceeding, Beatty pulled out the handcuff key he had somehow managed to stash, opened his cuffs, and fled the Harris County Criminal Courts building. He was recaptured post-haste, and subsequently sentenced to 8 years for the escape and 8 years for violating his probation, the sentences to run concurrently. Beatty's little game of playing cop was the last major action in the Tara Breckenridge case. No trace of Tara has ever been found. No information and really no clues as to her whereabouts. But plenty of renewed speculation came about after the Houston police identified the 1990 rapist of a Gigi's Club dancer as the same monster who raped and likely brutally murdered Cheryl Henry just a month later, along with murdering her date that night, Andy Atkinson. Several other Houston area disappearances around this time are also theorized to be connected to the Lover's Lane murders. Tragically, Tara's older brother Timothy died in 2008 at only 43 years old. According to some, he drowned in Lake Amistad during his parents' wedding anniversary party. Tara's younger sister, Toby, died at age 47 in 2017. The death is rumored to be suicide. Tara Breckenridge's older brother Todd and younger brother Bradley are still alive. Her father died in 2013, her mother Betty in 2016, never having learned much more about their daughter's disappearance than they did the first couple months after it happened. Tara Breckenridge's boyfriend, Wayne Hecker, is said to have died of cancer in Houston in 2015. We're unable to find an obituary for the man or any other evidence of his death for that matter. But anyway, after Tara disappeared, Hecker married and moved to Iowa, but eventually came back to Texas. He got in trouble here with the law some for possession and selling drugs, but no record of violence. If you have any information about the disappearance of Tara Breckenridge, please call Houston Crime Stoppers at 713-222-8477. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company, like Ancestry or 23andMe, to their database. If you haven't tested with one such company, you can get a kit directly from them by going to connect.dnasolves.com. Your DNA data there is only used for law enforcement investigations. At DNASolves.com, too, you can donate to one of the crowdfunding cases to help identify an unknown decedent or help solve a cold case in departments that need funding. We'll provide links in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold Podcast at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50 a month, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Slayer Saint and the Odessa Lust murders, among others. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate your support beyond words. The Houston Chronicle, the Del Rio News Herald, and the television show Unsolved Mysteries were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.